Hey fellow GNTers, those of us who like our gin with our tantra and our tantra with a little bit of a twist. In this episode, we continue with part two of our discussion with Mary Kay Ryan, the inimitable Mary Kay Ryan, shamanic practitioner and teacher and Chinese medical practitioner and teacher. Mary Kay's complete curriculum vitae is pretty extensive and her more complete bio is in the intro to episode one. But suffice it to say, she has decades of experience in practicing, teaching, and writing about Chinese medicine, including treating AIDS with Chinese medicine, one of the first textbooks addressing that subject. She also has decades of experience in shamanic practice, including teaching. Her passion is healing the village and the spiritual field, the truth that healing, by definition, must be a collective experience involving not only the individual, but other people, other living beings, and the entire natural world. In this episode, we discuss demystifying spirituality and remystifying religion, including creating a religion out of your own experience. We consider various definitions of what spirituality means and what the pitfalls and positives of various religious practices and institutions may be. Enjoy.
Welcome to Gin and Tantra, spirituality with a twist. The podcast that takes tantrism, Buddhism, Taoism, Sufism, Kabbalism, shamanism, Chinese medicinism, and all of the other isms we've been influenced by, and blends them into a tall, crisp, cool cocktail your spirit has been longing for.
I want you to get together.
Now, isn't that refreshing?
I want you to get together.
Very good. Yeah. So, I mean, Mary Kay, you're really, you know, what you're saying is talking to what it is that's sort of like the vision of our program, of what it is that we're trying to kind of bring to people. And I think there's a sentence that you said that I wrote down that I really think is emblematic is that we're doing here within this conversation and all the other ones we're having, is that you said creating a religion out of your own life experience. And I think that's fantastic. And so, you know, you're talking about like spiritual traditions, but you know, maybe before we even, you know, talk about spiritual traditions or the various isms of the world, maybe we could even talk for a moment about spirituality and what does that mean? We all probably could talk for a minute on it, but I'd like to hear what you have to say first on, for you, defining spirituality, right? What does that mean?
Well, I taught a class once at PCOM where Eric works, and it was called Spirituality in Medicine and Spirituality and Medicine, because I thought they were kind of two different things. And the first thing I went to a university where you were not allowed to say the word the unless you had defined it. And so I'm kind of a stickler for what do we actually mean by this word that we're tossing about? Mm-hmm. Because to me, the word spiritual, and it was very interesting because in this class, nobody had a very clear notion at all of what that was. And so, and I think that's kind of important if you're looking at different systems, because if you have a kind of rubric of what's included in these systems, then you can kind of measure against it with each system. So for instance, religious systems and by the way, I use the word religious only to mean collective spiritual institutions, period. And I do, and it is a neutral, value-free word to me. I do not hate religion. I don't hate institutions necessarily. It depends on the institution. So I see religions as kind of more institutionalized spiritual systems. Buddhism is a religion, and that's fine. That's nothing wrong with that. But so religions / spiritual systems have many components. They often have cosmologies, i.e., you know, how does the universe work? They have theories of origin and completion. Where did I come from? Where am I going? Where did the universe come from? Where is it going? They have ethics. That's a huge component, ethics. They have politics. That is, they say that there are certain right ways to organize authority and/or/ democracy. How are we going to take decisions? They talk about paranormal states. That is, are those good things or bad things? Should we get into them or not? They talk about other worlds. That is a huge part of most many spiritual systems, is this the only reality there is, or are there other realities? And if so, are there beings that live in them? Are those beings good or bad? Are there lots of them or hardly any of them? So I think it's important to think about all those. And, you know, I could go on, but I won't. People can sort of brainstorm their own list. It's important because when we get to shamanic practice, which, by the way, is not an ism and shouldn't technically be called shamanism, because it isn't, well, because it doesn't have a belief system at all. It has no authority structure, no political beliefs, no belief system at all. It does not require you to believe anything. It has no inherent ethical system. Wow. So how do we know that it's a spiritual system at all? Well, because it's extremely interested in other worlds outside this reality, and who might live in them and what our relationship to those beings might be and so forth. So that's the only reason I think it's good to kind of look at these definitions, so that we know that we look at them in a careful way. People tend to say religion, blech, you know, boo, religion is horrible. That's not true. I mean, religion, different religions are different, and they have dark and light sides, because everything has dark and light sides. So that's why I wanted to kind of go into that, because we just bandy that term about without really thinking very clearly what we mean by it. Oh, and also I didn't say another component is transcendence. That's a huge part of many spiritual systems, certainly Buddhism and Taoism, and also altered states, which goes to your psychedelics podcast. The deliberate use of altered states, which can be gotten into in lots of different ways. So those are some more components. And I think that you can categorize religions according to where their emphases are.
And would you say that your definition of religious, you know, religions, is that spirituality falls under that, is alongside of it? They are equal? Like, how would you put, you know, because the term spirituality, I mean, it's a large term.
It's a really large term.
How would you put them?
I think religions, at least from my understanding, a religion is a more is a collectively held belief system. It usually includes a belief system. A religion does. That's why I don't think shamanic practice is a religion. It does not have a belief system. And we can talk more about that. Sounds weird. There may be shamanic people out there going, "What does she mean? It has no belief system." So we can talk about that later. Because I can argue it pretty clearly. I don't mean it has no ideas. I mean, it doesn't have a belief system. And so a religion is a collectively held set of spiritual beliefs and or practices intended to do something, fill in the blank, intended to create a better world, intended to transcend this world, intended to whatever it's intended to do. Mm-hmm. And so religions are collectively held. They tend to have at least some kind of institution that can be pretty loose. Black churches, for instance, tend to be, the institution is the minister, and that's it. I mean, that's as high as you can go. So many black churches, not all, but in the United States, I mean. So that's all that I think a religion is. It's a spiritual system that incorporates those things, and therefore it could be bad or good. It would depend on, you know, what are your practices? What are your goals? What are your ethics? What are your, you know, all that stuff. And go ahead.
But in part of your definition, you use the word spiritual system. And so I'm asking
for
your definition of the word spiritual, the word spirituality, that our idea, because, you know, I'll have conversations, and I'm sure all of us do, and people who are listening to this as well, will have conversations and say, oh, it'll come up to, what do you believe in? And someone will say, oh, well, I don't believe in religion, but I'm very spiritual.
Right.
What, you know, just personally, like, what does that mean? And I ask Eric Isley the same thing, but Mary Kay, what does that mean to you?
Okay. To me personally, you mean, part of why I like, and was drawn to shamanic practices is because I don't have to believe anything that I don't experience. In fact, I've had multiple shamanic teachers say, if we haven't seen it or experienced it, or, and not just seen with your eyes, but experienced it, Mm-hmm. We don't believe it. You cannot tell us to believe something. That ain't how it works for us. And I really like that. In fact, one of the things about at least Tibetan Buddhism that I like, now, Eric, obviously you're the expert here, but my understanding, which is more than the average Joe and way less than Eric, is that you're not asked to believe a lot of things. You are, in fact, supposed to eat. I think there are like six ways you're supposed to measure whether or not a thing should be taken in. And that is through experience, through the teachings, which I think are in sacred texts, through your teachers, through logical argument. I love that. So I like that about Buddhism. They're not saying, believe it because we said so. But in shamanic practices, we don't believe anything unless we've experienced it. We don't. You don't go into a shamanic class and people say, this is what you need to believe. They might say, many shamanic cultures experience certain kinds of commonalities, and here's what they are. And yours may follow those. And that may give you kind of a little bit of a map as to where we're going. And I love that, because to me, I'm a very rational person. I'm a very intellectual and rational person. And I love the fact that there's some place that I can go where I don't need to have the answers. I don't have the answers. And that it's not about what I think and what I believe. It's about what I'm going to be seeing and be told and hear from outside myself. That is so much of a burden lifted off me that I don't actually need to have all the answers to every damn thing. You know?
That kind of gets back to the perfectionism point too, right? Yeah. You don't have to be perfect,
yeah,
right?
Right.
Yeah, have every answer, yeah.
Right.
Which is a lot of psychological load for a person to carry, right? Which I think a lot of us are carrying.
Yeah. And the funny thing, and we'll get into this when we talk more about shamanism, the thing about the spirits is they're not always nice at all. Sometimes they're pretty harsh and they tell you stuff you didn't want to hear. And it's often shocking. That's why you kind of know you can't possibly be making this up, because I never would have said that. You know, I would have told myself it was just fine to do such and such. So it's not like it's about somebody telling me how great I am or how I can do whatever I want. But it's still, there's a certain kind of loving kindness about it, even in the harshness. It's like, I'm going to tell you this. I know you don't want to hear it. And I bet you aren't even going to listen to me, but I'm going to tell you anyway. There's a kind of parental loving kindness to that I like. I mean, I don't know what other people want, but I like it. So for me, that's, I'm not particularly into, my dogmas or ideologies are about things in the material world. And I don't really want dogma and ideology dragged into my spiritual life much. However, having said that, that doesn't mean that every single ideology and every single spiritual system is wrong. I mean, the ethics of some of these systems is very good. Buddhism has some excellent ethical ideas that there's nothing wrong with most of them, and perhaps all of them. Christianity, I mean, you wouldn't know it from the way it gets practiced, but it has some pretty good provisos about ethics. So I'm not saying I disagree with those ethics. It's that if I need an ethical system, I can do that here in this world. You know what I'm saying? That's a thing. That's about belief to me and thought and intellect, not about my spiritual experiences.
So Eric, let me ask the same to you then. How do you define, because we all, again, same thing, right? Someone says, I don't believe in religion, but I'm a very spiritual person. What, to you, what are they referencing, or how would you explain that?
Well, first I have to say that I knew you'd end up batting cleanup on this particular project, Daniel. Of the three of us, you'd pick up the last one.
Yeah,
I was saying, okay, Daniel's going to stick me with this second after all of what Mary Kay said. I'm going to have to go second. Okay.
Oh, come on, Eric. Wow us.
Well, okay. I'm going to harken back to a couple of things. Actually, just as a little bit of a personal thing, kind of like Mary Kay, I was back in my undergrad at University of Chicago too. Go Maroons.
Yay.
And there was the whole thing
where you're not allowed to say the if you haven't defined it.
it was, you know, you have that kind of structure there. So, okay, so I'll try to talk about as personal as I can with this, hearkening back to some of the things that Mary Kay was saying. Mm-hmm. So for me, and I think we talked about this in one of the podcasts a little bit, what got me into this was sort of the Zen thing originally. I was struck by how thought-provoking that was, how, in a certain sense, kind of trickstery part of it was. It was like it really hit something in me. And I had the good fortune of just stumbling. I've got kind of good book karma, I guess I would say. So I stumbled across Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, the Shunryu Suzuki kind of classic. And I was, you know, in my 20s, you know, looking for things for sure. I definitely had a seeking mind. There were things I wanted to understand. And one of the things that jumped out at me was his saying, listen, I'm not going to give you any particular answers. I'm going to give you something you can do. Mm. So have some experiences. And then, you know, these experiences you'll have, and this will become part of how you're kind of building the answers up for yourself. He doesn't say it exactly that way, but it's kind of to that point. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, we'll give you some practices. And then, you know, other people have done these practices. Good things have happened. So probably good things will happen for you too. And probably some difficult things as well, right? There's always some light and some dark going on, but the dark things are things that are good to see anyways, right? And you learn about yourself on the road. And so I was like, okay, I can buy into that. I mean, if someone would have told me, believe this or that thing, I mean, I was raised Catholic.
Yeah.
So
me too.
I had that experience. And again, I'm not even anti-Catholic. It came up the other day with a student who was talking in class about her Catholicism. It just came up, honestly, on Friday. And I was like, you know, just to make it clear, I'm not anti-Catholic in any way. I don't practice it now. Right. A lot of people who are former Catholics have bad feelings about that. My uncle's a deacon. I understand why people practice it. You know, I see the flaws. I'm not going to say that I don't see the flaws, especially some of the deep flaws I'm going to see, you know, like how the damage that has been done by that institution outside of the teachings. I'm not going to not see that, obviously, but I'm not anti-Catholic or anything.
Yeah.
But anyways, being raised in that way, I thought that was refreshing to me. It was like, I'm not asking you to believe anything. It's more, I'm asking you to kind of participate in a process of experiences, and then you will learn along the way. And that I could buy into. Yeah, that I could buy into.
I like that. By the way, I was raised Catholic also, and I just want to say I have the same feeling as you. I'm not anti-Catholic, but I am certainly anti some of the horrible abuses of the institution over the millennia. And I had a very good experience as a Catholic. I would say that that was largely because it's a veiled pagan religion, but you know, it's only nominally monotheistic in my opinion. But that, you know, I did not have a bad experience, and I'm not particularly anti-Catholic. The institution's problematic, but
I don't think you can't turn a blind eye to the damage that's been done by the institution historically. Now you can't do that.
Horrible damage.
But that's even different from maybe some of the positive messages that are trying to come through, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I think it was an experiential thing for me, and I kind of went in. I mean, you can't be tabula rasa, but I went in with the attitude like, okay, I'm going to go in here and be as open as I can about these experiences and see what happened. And then all of a sudden you're on a journey and all kinds of things are going to happen, right? Then you're like, oh, like that's how the world is.
Right.
I didn't realize that was a thing.
Did you hear that, Daniel? He was on a journey.
Yeah, no doubt, right?
Yeah, right.
The things are going to happen. I can remember doing like my first Buddhist retreat and like, you know, it was very Zen, and the school I was in was kind of interesting because it was very Taoist. So Hakuin had a Taoist teacher in Japan. And so there were Taoist aspects. And I thought, well, this is great. You know, this is already sort of a little bit eclectic. And I thought, fantastic. And I went to do the retreat, and it was all kind of what you call probably in Tibetan sense, kind of like fire breathing, building up a lot of yang, building up Ming Men for our TCM people. So you do these deep breathing things, Kundalini.
Oh, yikes.
You know, if you're a yoga person. So kind of building up a lot of heat, you know. But I was like, this is actually having an effect. Like, there's no doubt this is doing stuff. So this is real.
Yeah.
You know, chi is a real thing. Okay, who knew? Okay, now I'm in.
Right. Now I'm in. Sort of, right.
You could just have those experiences and be like, okay, I'm learning. As I'm going through this and I'm learning, you know, there's all kinds of things that I wouldn't have known are things, and all of a sudden they're things.
You know, it's funny, Eric, because you're reminding me of when I was younger and people were talking about meditation. I was a Marxist and I was not an atheist, but I was pretty anti-religion in some ways. And meditation just sounded really boring to me. And nobody ever told me what it was going to do for me, except that they didn't like the way I was. And somehow it was going to make me be different in a way they were going to like. So I wouldn't be as loud. I wouldn't be as hostile, whatever it was they thought I should get rid of. And I sort of had an FU idea about that. I've said, you know, I'm okay with how I am. And it just sounded boring. And it was part of this whole, and also it was about transcendence. I was a Marxist. I don't believe that. It's not that I don't believe in transcendence. I don't believe in escapism. And so if somebody had told me all the things that meditation could do and the worlds it could open up for you and had like the tiniest bit of imagination instead of this kind of you shouldism and you're going to be so much better a person and it's not very appealing. I had a friend who was an alcoholism counselor who had himself been an alcoholic and a heroin addict. So this is some serious shit, right? And he used to go into rooms full of recovering drug addicts and alcoholics and say to them, I'm going to teach you how to get high in a way that not only won't hurt you, it's really good for you. And every person in the room was on board. Because these were drug addicts. They really, my one friend who was a priest said he thought a lot of drug addicts and alcoholics are people who want to change their consciousness, but don't have a way to do it that's healthy. And so he was giving them a tool that would allow them access to some things that they wanted to get to, but in a way that was healthy and that was in fact going to make them a healthier, happier person, you know? And so I think it's a shame because years later, after I'd done a lot of shamanic stuff and a lot of Qigong, I came back to sitting meditation and the no mind kind of meditation. And I loved it. I thought it was so fun and wonderful and great, but nobody ever sold me the product very well because it was sold in this perfectionism model that I didn't like.
Honestly, Mary Kay, I think that is an important part of this particular project, you know, the podcast for Daniel and I, because whenever it comes up, I try to like emphasize those traditions, those practices that have happiness and pleasure and bliss, you know, and, you know, as opposed to, you know, even in, you know, in Buddhism, you know, there's the whole Four Noble Truths and everything is suffering. And I mean, that's the tough love part of the teaching, but there's like bliss in this too.
Yeah, right.
And people don't say, no, the point of this is not, you know, to recognize that, you know, things are suffering and terrible. I mean, you can look out your window and see that, you know. It's more like to recognize that there's actually these aspects that are blissful, right?
Yep.
And it's the blissful part that I think is this, again, I'm talking very personal, but that's the part that's curative in the end.
Right. Right.
You know, that's the part that actually does the healing. If you want to get clinical too, right?
I had a patient that I was seeing because he'd had some psychotic episodes and we were trying to make sure he didn't have any more. And he was very interested in Buddhism and eventually went off and became a Buddhist monk in Japan. But I said, you know, you're never going to sell the product with a motto like all life is suffering. For God's sake. I mean, really, you've got to start somewhere else. That is a horrible place to start. And he said, I think you're misunderstanding that phrase. And I said, really, what do you mean? And he said, I think they mean that all life is irritating, that there's a sense in which if you move through it the wrong way, you're always being rubbed the wrong way by it. It just feels annoying a lot. And sometimes it feels horrible and suffering. But he meant just regular, ordinary people have this, you know, why is the line so long? Why is the traffic in my way? Why is it raining when I didn't want it to? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, oh, all life is annoying. Okay, I get that. It was so funny. It was so funny. But I think, and to any Taoist, if you say all life is suffering, they're going to say, no, it's not. Because suffering can't exist without joy. It wouldn't even exist if there wasn't a thing called joy, because we wouldn't recognize it as suffering. It would just be how things are. You know, there's no water to a fish and there's
So I think that was important in like the way that this whole podcast was being structured. It's like wherever this is possible, that's not to be a counter message to that part of any spiritual teaching. That's, I mean, that stuff is, there's a truth to that too, because if you don't see the fact that they're suffering, then there's a naivete behind that. And sure, there could be a blindness.
Absolutely.
That doesn't recognize what's going on with other people. We deal with people who are sick. We deal with people
right,
who are troubled. You have to see that part of reality. That's your one part of your yin and yang almost, right?
Exactly.
To see that part. But yeah,
but our job as doctors is to try to alleviate suffering. So obviously there's something called not suffering. Otherwise, patients wouldn't come to us. They would just continue to be sick. They would just assume that's just how life is. But they come and they say, hey, I'm suffering. Can you help me out here? And then we try as best we may to help them. So I think here's my motto. I'm going to start my own religion. Here's the motto. Ready? All life is tricky.
Yeah.
Because life is tricky. That is sure. And you say that to any person, and they're going to go, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. I mean, unless they're like 12 or something. But if they've had any life experience, they're going to go, oh, yeah, yeah, that's for sure true.
Yeah, life is a mix, and it's slippery.
It is slippery.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay.
Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, so Justin, so we can, you know, kind of move our conversation forward here a little bit.
Sure.
Oh no, Daniel, you got to do your spirituality.
Oh,
definition.
I am.
Oh, that's true.
Oh, okay.
Right on,
okay.
Eric. Don't let him speak.
Yeah, no.
You're talking about being slippery and tricky. Hello.
Hello. And here's Daniel, the slime
trickster. Thy name is Daniel.
Yeah, that's exactly. Right.
I really enjoyed listening to your guys's, sort of definitions and experience, defining it for yourselves. But I actually think that they are almost identical, really, and that I tried to write it down, and I said experience as the motivator and the validator, and I like that because it's concise, and I like to be concise, but I think it's really kind of the truth, and it is for me as well, that the experiences that we have that are meaningful for us in life, whether they be sort of paranormal, out of body, or even in the completely normal sense of everyday life, the ones that stick out and have value are validation for the things that we have been doing that led up to that point that got us to have that moment. Mm-hmm. And then simultaneously their motivation for us to continue or not continue doing something, or, you know what I'm saying? But like,
yes,
they provide the background to want us to go, oh yeah, I really enjoyed that. I want to experience more and deeper, and I'm willing to make the sacrifices in my life so that I can experience those things more. And that's really, for me, this sort of spiritual experience, the spiritual led life. And you're like, well, I could certainly go out and do these particular things, whatever they are, but that might take away from my time or my mental energy or change my life in such a way that might not bring me down to the place where I want to be, where I had this experience. It's not to hold on, to attach to like certain things, like, you know, like you're addicted to it, but it's positively motivating. These are positive motivational factors that kind of drive your life, drive your psyche, you know, drive your happiness in a sense, and make you believe, as to something that someone said in one of the classes I was in with you, Mary Kay, that that there is something that is beyond the obvious.
Yes.
And that there are ways in which we could perhaps have access to that. And that is ultimately rejuvenating, you know, and very motivating. So for me, I think we're all saying the same thing. And it's actually quite nice because, you know, we all studied Chinese medicine. We have our own, you know, internal beliefs, but we have some similarities. But this particular definition was about repeated in three different experiences, which is actually quite cool.
And let me just add one quick sentence, which is, I think a piece of why people are so negative these days about religion, so-called, is because what I consider to be purely political reasons, that is power dynamic relationships, spirituality has been morphed in certain areas into basically systems that are anti-experience and authoritarian at their deepest heart of hearts. So when I, years ago, I was trying to be a Unitarian, and I took a class called The Haunting Church, in which you kind of look at your, what experiences you've had in your life that were spiritual. And almost everyone in the group felt that when they'd had an experience that they felt was spiritual, it had been invalidated by the religious authorities who were in charge of them. So instead of it being like lauded or praised, and those experiences were like being a child and feeling oneness with all that was around them, hearing voices, not in the, you know, in the detrimental, scary sense, but in the very positive, supportive sense, and so on and so forth, seeing angels, whatever it was that they experienced had actually been invalidated by religious authorities. And that's a sad thing. And so I think people are very hostile to things they think are going to interfere with their ability to have some kind of actual experience of what's called in this thing I'm watching on Netflix, The Hidden. The Hidden. They call the spirits The Hidden, which I thought was quite a neat way to call them. It's interesting.
Well, this came up in our psychedelics episode too, where there's obviously kind of a in the European church and the European Christian structures, there is this hostility towards altered state of consciousness.
Yes.
You know, it just seems like a thing. Now, you know, you can talk a lot of ways about that, but why, I mean, from your perspective, Mary Kay, why do you think that developed, or what do you think that, is that just about power and authority, or do you see there's some other thing going on there beyond that, or how do you think about that?
I have thought about this a lot, because Christianity has developed certain things that seem to me to be very interesting. It's more negative, what we might call negative aspects are very interesting to me. So I think there are a number of reasons that Christianity was so hostile to certain kinds of states. One is that they were reacting early on to Roman paganism, which was pretty nasty. Some of it, I mean, they did in fact sacrifice babies in some of these Roman cults. So there was probably a response to this so-called ecstatic worship that was nasty, that was pretty icky. So there's that. So there was some valid fear about sort of ecstatic, worshipful, ceremonial stuff. That may have been valid. And so I don't want to just say, oh, it's because they were jerks or something. However, and the second thing that I would say is kind of valid that I've run into as a shamanic teacher is that, and maybe you could speak to this, Daniel, occasionally you do sort of see that it can be kind of dangerous. I think you talked about this vis-a-vis meditation also, Eric. If you don't have a guide or someone there to help you, now, never mind psychedelics, yeah, but any very profoundly altered state has a potential to be dangerous. That's part of what makes it profound. That's the dark and the light of it. And without any kind of teacher or somebody there to guide you, AKA authority, then you can go into some very dark and dangerous places. I had a friend who was a student at the Midwest Center who ended up in a psych ward after a shamanic class because there was no follow-up and no help for him when he started to have a very negative experience. So that might be the second reason, is an actual fear that bad things can happen to you. Those are the two valid reasons that I think Christianity might have developed a fear. However, the Romans had already persecuted witches. So, and clairvoyants and anybody who had paranormal abilities were already being persecuted. And that got taken into Christianity wholesale. That's part one. And they were, the Romans didn't like these people because they were a state and they didn't like alternate authorities. And that's the darker side, is that people who have paranormal abilities are perceived to be potential leaders. They're leaders. The community listens to them, particularly tribal Europe. They would have had their own shamans and their own holy people. The Romans cut the Druids' tongues out so they couldn't speak. That's how afraid they were of them, because they, back then, a shaman was a community leader often, and they advised the chieftains and so on. So they weren't only in the spirit world, they were also in the material world. And so I think that the darker side of this fear is, oh my God, these people have access to information and authority that we can't control. And that's actually when you start to see the development of priesthoods. This happens in Egypt. It also happens in Greece, which is the state wants to be able to control the religious authorities. It also happens in China, because the shamans out in the countryside, those rulers during the Warring States period and all, they were worried about those people, because those people had followings, people listened to them. And so I think that's the darker side of Christianity being afraid of these altered states, is that the people who knew how to access them, but also who could help others access them, were creating authority, what would you call it, conglomerations of authority that was outside the Roman Empire, the Roman Christian Empire. So wise women and, you know, healers and all those people. So that would be kind of the dark side of it. The other last thing, which is a shamanic thing, is that the way shamanic people need power in a neutral sense, in the same way you need electricity to run a light bulb. In order to be able to do what we do, we have to have access to power. And we get that through our relationships with our various spirits. And so I think that if you are an authoritarian structure who wants to disempower people, there are two things you can do. One, make them feel guilty. Guilt is an extremely energetically disempowering thing to do. It eats up people's chi. So you want to create a system that is based on guilt. And by the way, perfectionism, which is the sister to guilt. And secondly, you want to keep them away from the spirits. And that means all altered states in which, where they might be able to get power. In the electrical kind of empowered sense, not in the political sense. So that's why I think, because I think Christianity has up until the Protestant Reformation, well, it's a very complicated history, so let me not oversimplify it, but
yeah.
It was in part an imperial system, in part. And so you're going to have dynamics that have to do with political, the maintenance of political power, more than spirituality.